August 10th marks the 37th annual Prisoners' Justice Day. It's a day to remember and protest the unnatural deaths of men and women inside prison. Tonight, I'm joined by three women who have lost family members and fellow prisoners as a result of the conditions inside prison and the gaps in our justice system. Mo Korchinski, Wendy Sproul, and Katrina Cody are here to remember the ones they've lost for Prisoners' Justice Day. Good evening, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
So, Wendy, you've brought with you a list of names of some of the women you served time with inside prison who died either inside or soon after they were released. Could you read those names for me?
Sure. And this is just a few off the top of our head. We have Myrna Walkus, Jen Churchill, Melissa Glover, Amanda Orenschuk, Iva Seicher, Shannon Rogers, Cassie Rowell, Jennifer Flavel, Suki Baroque, Tammy Bayard, Paige Williams, Tammy Turner, Kim Collins, Jackie Mack, Deb Pelche, Sonia Cattarelli, and Maxine Chambers.
Any other names that you want to add to that, Katrina or... No?
No, that's my list too.
There's been so many, it's off the top of my head, it's just remembering all of it, but there has been so many more that, you know, I know in the years that I've been in that I've seen go.
Yeah.
And I know personally I've lost my husband 2 years ago, passed away as a result of assault in a prison.
I guess what goes through your mind when you hear those names read out?
Sadness. I remember a couple of them that were really close to me, and that, you know, I actually witnessed, you know, that morning that, you know, I remember one of the girls had passed away in her cell, and all of our windows were papered, and in the morning they wouldn't let us out, and, you know, nobody was getting information or anything, and you know, it took us a few hours before we finally clued into that, you know, somebody passed away in the middle of the night.
I guess, Katrina, how significant is it, or like, how rare or often does this happen that someone dies inside prison, you know, from your knowledge in terms of when you were inside?
Well, I mean, I've got 11 years in, and I know every woman on that list, and that's just the women, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, probably just as many men who've not made it out either, and so it does. It happens every day, and this is just in our province.
Yeah. Wow. I guess, did you all kind of observe Prisoners' Justice Day while you were inside, or... Wendy, do you want to talk a bit about what would happen inside the prison on Prisoners' Justice Day?
Well, we all kind of observe it in our own way, but we that have been in for maybe more time than some of the younger inmates would educate them and try and let them know what it was all about. And then there's groups like Joint Effort that come in and try to help us observe it. Like, they come in and let us silkscreen our own T-shirts with the logo for Prisoners' Justice Day that... somebody in prison actually designs a different one every year. And so we used to take part in those kind of activities, and it's also kind of an unspoken tradition that you fast on that day. So a lot of us tried to do that and educate other people on, you know, they would obviously ask, why are you fasting today? And so we would give them information. But the warden and the guards that are working inside saw that as bullying. They tried to frame it as if we were bullying inmates into observing it, which is not the case at all in my experience. People were interested, so we would explain it to them. They would choose to come along with us or not. But, and then also with the T-shirts that Joint Effort would bring us, they're just plain, ordinary white T-shirts that we silkscreen something on. There's nothing dangerous or harmful there, anything more than the T-shirts that they give us, which are gray. And they wouldn't let us keep them. We had to silkscreen them, let them dry, and then as soon as they were out of our hands, they were put in our effects for when we got out.
And how did that make you feel?
Well, it minimized our efforts, and it kind of put a shadow on anything that we tried to do. There's so very little that you have in there that's of any kind of meaning, you know, that's any personal meaning. And we tried to negotiate with the warden and the powers that be and ask them, like, how is this t-shirt going to be of any issue? And they just kept saying, no, you know, they could get stolen, you could be bullying people and taking theirs, which is ridiculous.
Or gang related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Katrina, the history behind this day is something that you feel is very important. Can you just tell us a bit about where this day comes from?
I belong to a support group too, Lincoln. It's long-term inmates now in the community. And so from speaking with Glenn, and that's Glenn Flett, and I guess Glenn was at Millhaven Institution back in the day in the 70s when this took place. And I just know from a personal experience with my own husband spending 7 years in the Quebec SHU on 23-hour lock that, you know, you get hopeless. And I guess that guy took his life, and then there was a bunch of other inmates who took their lives too that night to protest. So that's how it all came about. But I mean, it's an everyday thing. It's an everyday thing that happens to not only the men, but the women. You know, they get shipped out of the province, taken away from their families and their kids. You know, they just get hopeless.
I know that, as you've mentioned, you lost your own husband. Can you tell us a bit about what happened to him, and just a bit about him and who he was? And
who Blair was. Blair was larger than life. He was funny. He was everything that, you know, that I wanted, and I seen it so much good in him. And I know for a fact that he didn't fight back that day. He got hit in the head, in the side of the head with a 10-pound weight, and knocked out, and then kicked for God, I don't even know how many minutes. And it was all on tape. And there was one staff member down in the gym, because it happened at Fraser Regional Correctional Center. And I guess it took about 20 minutes before they got him airlifted out of there. So he laid on the floor for 20 minutes without any assistance. And so the doctor said they don't know whether he died from, or he succumbed to his injury, because he didn't actually, it took a long time for him to pass away, almost a year. But it was possibly from being without an airway. So because of his size and whatever, the warden felt it that it wouldn't be safe for his staff to approach and intervene until there was medical attention there.
So somebody made a decision that it wasn't safe to go and help a seriously injured man who clearly at that point, if he's not breathing or is unable to adequately breathe, is probably no threat to what is supposed to be trained in first aid and emergency response type staff.
Yeah, I've heard that they all have to have that training, but
absolutely they do.
Yeah, it was clearly known. I wasn't even told by the, and they knew that. I mean, we've been married since 2001, and I visit 4 days a week. We talked 20 times a day on the phone, and I was told by an inmate, and the RCMP showed up the next day. Corrections had still never called me and even told me.
Did they give you any explanation as to why they wouldn't call you?
No. I didn't really have too much good dealings with corrections at first, because it happened to be one of the deputy warden and whoever was acting at the time used to be one of our old staff members, and so I didn't really have a good rapport with him, and so I kind of got shuffled out of the way. And of course, you know, my credibility, because I'm an ex-convict, is not the greatest. And yeah, it was just really mishandled, the whole thing, and it caused you know, so much difficulty and heartache at like the most difficult time of our lives. Right, I just had gone through a serious illness, and I was given for the first week 1 hour daily visits with him. And clearly he was fighting for his life. I wasn't visiting anymore.
Do you have any, were you given any explanation as to like how this attack even happened, or how he was even attacked inside prison, where you think, you know, there should be supervision, things like that shouldn't be happening, right?
Well, and there's some concern I have with that too, because from what I have been told, he was actually put on a unit with some incompatibles, which mean they've had problems before, and so that classification shouldn't have never put them together in the first place. And I was told that by the RCMP the next day. So corrections really hasn't really helped out. I'd like to find out all those answers, because still I really don't know.
Was there any sort of investigation into this afterwards?
No, I haven't. Nobody's contacted me about the inquiry or anything yet. As far as I know, the inquiry hasn't happened.
Wow. And can you tell us when this happened?
It happened. He was assaulted on May the 19th, 2010, and he passed away April 3rd, 2011. Mm. So he was still alive for 11 and something months. But in a state of just like, he was suspended. He was just there, but not there.
And what was that whole time like for you?
Well, I just had a double mastectomy, so I was really sick myself. And, you know, I was, Blair was supposed to be coming home, and this was all supposed to be over and put behind us. And I really believed him this time. And he just didn't make it home.
Does it strike anyone else as ironic that in an environment where we're not allowed to have a memorial t-shirt, somebody can get their head caved in with a 10-pound weight?
Yeah.
Yet our t-shirts are not acceptable for us to keep in our own possession?
Yeah. Or stickers from your children on mail.
Yeah, they send that back too.
Yeah. I actually had death threats made too about that if I had complained or made any riff and if they had lost the weights, that there would be issues that I would have to deal with.
And these are threats from the other prisoners that were responsible for this?
I don't know if they're responsible for it, but obviously they care about if they're free weights or if they're universals. I've never been in an institution where they had free weights. We all had universals.
Wow.
Because, people will resort to anything in there, right? I mean, locks in socks, soup cans in socks, 10-pound weights, or...
That's just asking for it.
But
the other day when I talked to you, you had mentioned that, this has happened, that you've been contacted by another family.
Mm-hmm. Where I was contacted by a family in Manitoba whose brother was in the same institution and apparently assaulted by the same group of individuals, and basically the same thing had happened to him, and he ended up to be blind, and he's learning to walk over again and talk over again, and his mentality, I guess, is that of maybe a small child. But his family called me, actually got a hold of me through Facebook, and they wanted answers for what happened to their brother and their son. And I said that, that I didn't really know, because I've been having myself such a hard time. I don't have millions of dollars to dish out for lawyers or whatever, but I definitely, if there's a lawyer out there that wants to look at that tape, what happened that day?
Inside the women's prison, how common is this situation where you would be placed in the same unit with someone you had a conflict with, or is there that same sense of danger for women?
I think it's a little bit different, no more or less serious though, because I think that when women finally decide to hold that kind of a grudge, that sort of hatred that requires some sort of physical retaliation, they take it to the maximum. Whereas, men, it's kind of in their nature to, they'll punch a guy in the face and then 2 days later they'll be buddies again. Women aren't so much like that. We either take care of each other and nurture each other, or we have a hatred that runs so deep. And there's also the classification and putting people on different units with people is really hard, because we don't voice our concerns to the guards. It's an us and them kind of mentality. So there's a good chance that nobody's ever going to say, I can't be with so-and-so on this unit. And, oftentimes the guards create problems for people that, are more likely to be victimized, because without the one who might be victimized, the I'll call her the weaker one, she might appear to have an issue with someone, and the guards will step in and classify her in some other unit, which makes it look like she told on somebody. You know, just by stepping in when they're not asked to, they create more problems than they need to.
Sorry, Mo, I'm just going to ask you to share Katrina's microphone, because that one doesn't seem to be working. We can just move it over a little bit. I guess deaths don't just happen inside prison. There have been quite a few women who've died after being released. So I guess, can you just, you've been doing some research with women who've been released from prison. Can you just talk a bit about, you know, why these women end up losing their lives after they're released from prison?
I mean, that's one of my biggest issues is, you know, why are women, for me, is why are women dying who have been in prison? Like, where's the rehabilitation, what prison's supposed to be? You know, the chances of them coming out and, you know, finding safe, affordable housing is, you know, very few do. Like, one of the research studies we did was 85% of the women coming out are homeless. You know, they can't get jobs, they, you know, they're restrained from their families. Society doesn't unlock the gate to society for them. I mean, they just send them out there, and the judgment you get after having been in prison is, you know, it carries for years. And a lot of people just give up. You know, how do you keep trying to fit into a society who won't, you know, forgive you for your mistake of being, and most people are in there because they're drug addicts. You know, you clean up and you still can't change your life. Like, when's it good enough? And a lot of people just give up. And it's sad.
I can speak to that. I've never been truly homeless until I got out of prison after being locked up for 4 years in a provincial facility, which has no sort of reintegration type programming. So basically after that much time, they just opened the gates and said, off you go. So I was homeless for the very first time ever. I've never really been someone who struggled with a lot of depression or suicide until I got out of prison. And having left behind a crystal meth habit and been clean for many years now, I've felt suicidal at least 15 times in the last 3 years, just trying to get over the bias, the prejudice, trying to do the right thing and not really seeing, you know, the rewards of doing the right things. And so, yeah, I would say that there's a whole lot of residual prisoner sort of things that follow you even though you've been released.
Mm-hmm. I actually was talking with my past warden. I was with her for probably about 11 years, Nancy Renshaw, and I had lunch with her last week, and I'd asked her, will it ever go away? Like, you know, will they ever not judge me? And she said, probably not, you know. It's just the way it goes, right? But
it's a very,
it needs to change, yeah. But, you know.
It's very unforgiving.
It's true, right? It's true.
Do you have any thoughts on how we can change that, on how we can make things better?
By us coming on the radio, speaking, doing documentaries, writing books, and really getting society to see who we are as people. You know, that we are mothers, sisters, grandmothers,
daughters,
you know.
Aunts, cousins.
Like, we're people. I mean, this could happen to anybody out there. You know, most of us are, because we, you know, we had a drug addiction. We did it to support our drug habit. You know, we're not bad people. We had a disease of addiction, right? And we're good. We've got, you know, smart, intelligent. You know, like, we have a lot to offer to society if society would let us. But for some reason, society doesn't want to.
And they now have, you know, how most jobs with any sort of vulnerable people or children or any of those kind of jobs, which is something that a lot of us are well suited for because we've developed a lot of empathy, a lot of understanding. We've had varied life experiences which take us to the sort of places where the people that ask for help are. So we are well suited for that type of work. But now, if you get a criminal record check, there's only two categories. There's two categories, suitable or not suitable to work with vulnerable people. No explanations, no room for any kind of circumstantial, you know, let me explain to you what happened to me. It's simply, you are or you are not. And that's thanks to our wonderful Bill C-10, which has just come into effect, that if anybody's at all interested in this subject, they should probably go online and look up Bill C-10 and just read a little bit about it. Anybody with any kind of, you know, family members that have been on federal parole, this is going to change their lives in not a good way.
or society, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean,
it does not make coming behind us.
It doesn't make society any safer to take somebody who's standing at a crossroads between a violent criminal past and a bright future. They're standing at that crossroads, and then you put some sort of restriction or some judgment on them that makes them feel completely worthless. Which way do you think they're going to turn? Back to what they know? Back to where they don't feel things? I would guess that would probably be the first choice.
Mo, you were looking over the list of names of women before we came here into studio, and you were saying that some of these women were actually doing really well before they died.
Well, they, you know, how well. I mean, yeah, they're staying clean and they can sit there and, you know, I mean, they stay out here for a year staying clean. I mean, fighting an addiction is hard enough, you know, and then it's like, well, where do you go from here? Like, you know, I can't get a job, I can't go to school because I can't do an apprenticeship, you know, I can't do my practicum because I can't get a criminal record check, so you can't even go to school and you can't get a job. A lot of them just give up. The depression, like the girls were saying here, you know, depression, it's like, you know, why? And you don't want to go back to that addiction world. I mean, it's not that easy either, the addiction world.
There's nothing to be proud of there. Right. I mean, you do one or two things that, you know, you can take some pride in, and then for whatever reason, your criminal history catches up and puts, you know, squashes that. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to just turn back to what you know, and, you know, drugs and alcohol is the best way not to feel unpleasant feelings. It's just
a slow way of killing yourself.
It really is, but I mean, the system creates recidivism, which is repeat offenses, because they make it more difficult to build a proper life than to just simply recommit a crime. How many times shortly after you're released do you get the feeling where I'll just go back to jail, because in jail I don't have to make any choices for myself, I don't have to pay my rent, I don't have to worry about feeding myself, you know, people take me to the doctor when I have doctor's appointments, they come and get me. I mean, I'm not saying that jail life is easy by any means, but it certainly does condition you to a certain amount of relying on other people to meet your needs and for them to tell you, in fact, what your needs are. I mean, how many people in... Even in short-term custody, they're shipped to a doctor and told that they need certain medications. People in any facility are so over-medicated. I mean, you just go in there and they immediately start looking for a reason to put you on Seroquel and Valium and whatever will, like, slow you down and just subdue you.
And does that create addictions in itself?
Well, they never get off the addiction, so they're just taken from one to another.
Yeah, and if you
give people in there that actually passed away from overdosing on the medication that they were given in the institution.
Yeah,
three people on that list right there.
And in the provincial jail, the medical system inside is privatized, so the medication what they're on inside the jail, they can't get out here anyways. Mm-hmm. So then coming off of some of these, you know, drugs isn't healthy. You know, you got to wean off of them. Well, these people are coming off cold turkey. And then how do they get relief? They go back to the street drugs, right? So we're just creating, you know, this whole circle, a revolving back and forth, right? They're not even cleaning up inside jail where they should be getting the help.
We don't even have the choice as to when and what medications we take. For instance, I was in jail when the H1N1 flu was a big thing. It was the first year of it and everybody was panicking. And they brought in some flu pills that were not available to the market at large. We were told that if we didn't take them, we would be put in segregation and locked until we absolutely decided to comply. I looked into this particular medication, and it was a test medication. They forced us all to take test medications.
And this was this part of some sort of drug trial? Like, they were still testing it out? And
I would have to assume so, because how would the medical system get the drugs unless somebody had released it for a trial, right?
Same with the flu shot. You take the flu shot, too.
Yeah, and then we got the flu shot 1 year, and it was for the year of the flu shot from before. And then so we all got really, really sick because it wasn't the right flu shot. And so we got this really, really bad flu from, like, the year we got it from. But if you think about it, 90% of the medications they give in jail are antipsychotic. You won't go in for a headache or a pain in your back or whatever, and you're given a pill that's actually an antipsychotic. And I don't understand that, how they're giving antidepressant pills for headaches and for toothaches and for backaches, and 90% of the inmates are all on the same drug.
Like, it's high. It's, you know, like we say, I think it's from our research study, we asked women, like when we entered 400 women, how many were on medication. I think it was like almost 85% were on meds inside prison. And that's a large amount of meds.
Wow.
You know, let's keep them drugged up and we can handle them.
And they were all on the same kind of meds, right?
Yeah.
I'm just going to take a second to let our listeners know that you are listening to Stark Raven on Vancouver Co-op Radio. The time is 7:43, and tonight we're hosting an hour-long discussion about Prisoner's Justice Day. My guests are Moog Kerchinski, Wendy Sproul, and Katrina Cody. They're here to tell us about the friends and loved ones who they've lost in prison or soon after being released. I guess I just want to ask you a bit about, you know, what's gotten you through to today, and how, I mean, where is that point where, you know, the women on this list, you know, who've died either inside or outside of prison, I guess, how do you stay on the right track and avoid falling down that road?
Well, for me, part of staying on that right track is reminding myself that it's okay to ask for help or support from someone else. For the longest time, I had too much pride or too much shame or whatever to ever admit that I wasn't doing okay. And I think just looking over this list, I can see at least six names on there that I know were that type of women also, who had too much pride to ask for help or to even admit that there was anything wrong. And until I learned how to do that and hooked up with other people that had also been released from prison and gone through some similar experiences to me, did I start to feel, well, maybe this stuff is kind of normal, and maybe I do need to just, you know, talk it out with somebody who can understand, who's been there, who's not a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a doctor, but someone who's actually lived the experience and can relate. So I think, you know, the biggest thing is just asking for the support that you need when you need it and finding it. I mean, so many times I've asked for help and, you know, from, say, the medical profession, they'll send you to a psychologist or a psychiatrist who will simply ask you a few basic questions, give you some little exercises on self-talk. And, I mean, you can only tell yourself so much, and if it's not matching your reality, it just doesn't jive. But basically, it's a kind of a solidarity thing. Not only are you together on the inside, but you need to stay together on the outside to people that are doing well, which is why we started, or we're attempting to start, a peer mentoring program, which is women who have lived prison experience and are now doing better will meet the women at the gates as they're released and assess their first three priorities, which is usually housing, healthcare, and reuniting with their family relationships. And for 3 days, we will spend time with those women and kind of make sure that they follow through on those goals, because everybody has big plans when they get out, but the minute you hit the street, those plans can change. So, yeah, peer mentoring, being connected, it's all really good, but at the same time, you still need somebody from general society to just look past the prison experience and realize that that's only one experience in a whole lifetime.
Katrina, I kind of want to go back to what happened with Blair, because that is a completely different situation where he was attacked. And I mean, how do we keep people safe when they're inside prison and when they're not susceptible to those same demons that we're talking about right now, where, you know, it's actually the institution that is a danger mm-hmm. to them?
I think there's a lot of things that need to be changed within the prison system. Like, I definitely have some questions on what happened that day. I've not been given any answers. I've not been ever been talked to officially by corrections. It was the RCMP the next day who actually came and got me at my house, and it was an inmate who phoned me about 20 minutes after the incident happened and told me, you know, that he thought that it was Blair that was in the gym mm-hmm. and that had been airlifted out. And I had called the institution all night, left messages. No answer. Nobody ever called me back. And then it was in the morning at about 10 o'clock when the RCMP knocked on the door. And I immediately went after I was interviewed with the RCMP. And they were really nice at the time and, you know, very compassionate. And they drove me right to Royal Columbian. And I tried to go in to visit because they said, you need to go and be with him now, right? You know, he's pretty sick. And I went there and I just started going through the emergency. And I found him in a trauma room with the two guards. And he was shackled and handcuffed to the bed. And his head was just huge. It was probably four times the size, and he had runner marks all over his face. And they told me they were going to arrest me if I didn't leave, but they didn't want me there. And then so I phoned the warden. I got a hold of the warden that day, and they told me I had to go through the regular booking process to book a visit with him. So I had to phone the visits line 24 hours before every time. So I had to sit for the first week every day for 45 minutes on hold, waiting for them to answer so that I could book a visit to go in to visit him at Royal Columbian. And then I just phoned back one day and I told Mr. McKessick, I said, listen, like, you know, I said, aren't you married? Like, wouldn't you want your wife to be there if it was you? And he said, yeah, just turn the car around and go back.
And this is the warden that you were talking to?
He was the acting deputy warden at the time.
I think that correctional services isn't held accountable for so many of their decisions. They are an entity unto themselves, and the people that they serve or that they service, are for the most part not able to fight for their own justice. You know, when someone treats you unjustly, I mean, if someone gives you the wrong change at Starbucks, do you not stand up and say, excuse me, you gave me the wrong change, can you correct your mistake? People that are under the control of correctional services don't have the right or are not afforded the right to stand up and say, excuse me, you treated me badly and I would like this repaired. It's simply, there is no process in place. There's a complaint process, but it's all handled internally. So, I mean, and your credibility is already damaged because it's an us and them mentality. And as much as prisoners hold that us and them feeling, so do the guards, which is wrong because you're dealing with human beings. And when you're dealing with human beings, if you put yourself on a level above the human being that you're dealing with, you can't effectively meet on common ground. So I think accountability is a big thing. They need to not be an entity unto themselves, and they need to be accountable.
Mo, do you have any thoughts on how we can keep prisoners safe inside and...
yes, read Resting Hope. No, we just wrote a book with... a bunch of us got together and a physician at one of the prisons, ACCW. I narrated it, the doctor from inside narrated it, and we had the warden, she's also wrote in it. And we wrote a book what was based on 4 years when Alouette Correctional Center was basically a healing lodge. There was nobody who went into segregation. You know, if you got in trouble, you had to clean windows. There was no us and them. Like, the inmates had a voice. You know, we had her put in to get, you know, sunglasses and hair dryers and curling irons and sports stays, like, stuff like that, to make it more of what reality life is, you know, and showing people that you can have fun without the dope. And so we ran, the jail was ran like that for about 4 years, and then of course, you know, government changed and that all changed. So we've actually wrote a book called Arresting Hope, what talks about the stories, and a lot of women have wrote their stories and their life stories and what it was like in there and the hope they got. One thing, when the mother baby program was in there, and you know what it was like having babies inside the prison and how healing it was even for all the inmates. I mean, for me, that was one of the things what turned my life around, was, you know, I had to start healing for my own having my own children in my life. And you know, so it was healing for a lot of people, you know. And now we only have what? You know, they've basically taken the mother baby program away from anywhere in Canada.
Both
now.
Institutions in British Columbia.
Yeah, anywhere in Canada. Like, we're one of the only countries in the world what doesn't have mother baby programs. You know, like, yeah, Canada's going backwards in their correction, you know, what corrections is doing, instead of going forward. And it's only going to cost the public more money. And, you know, crime's going down, but let's get tougher.
Crime's not going down, is it?
Yeah, the crime rate's gone steadily down in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Not by huge amounts, but steadily down.
Yeah.
I guess my final thought is just it's been 37 years since the first Prisoners' Justice Day protest or demonstration by prisoners inside to try to, you know, stop people from dying behind bars. And I guess just what are your final thoughts on where, just on this day, or where we need to go from here?
I think that we would all do well to remember that there are people that are inside every day of the year. But I mean, if they can only have one day to be appreciated, then why not make it August 10th?
Mm-hmm. Katrina?
Prisoners' Justice Day has always been something that I've participated in with the groups that I belong with, and it was an outing for me at first and didn't really hold as much meaning as it does now. And I know definitely that, you know, I'll be with my support group this year, and because it definitely means a lot more to me now.
How about you?
For me, I just hope, you know, more people in the general population, you know, knows about, you know, Prison Justice Day and what it means, and about how many people do die inside and outside of jail, and who shouldn't be dying. You know, this isn't a war zone, and people, you know, it's just unreal how many. I mean, if you look at the list of how many people have died in the Prison Justice Day pamphlet, you know, it's pages and pages and pages. Like, it's ridiculous how many people are dying. And it needs to stop. And, you know, it's 2012. Like, why are people still dying?
Somebody else's family member one day.
I mean, it's got to affect so many people, but more people got to speak up. And, you know, and let's take the power away from the government and corrections and, you know.
Just because they're prisoners doesn't make them any less of a person.
We're still citizens of this, you know, citizens, you know. We still have a right to vote, even if we're inside prison, mm-hmm. right? And we still have the rights, but we don't have any rights, and that's where it needs to change. People in prison need to still have their human rights.
Well, I want to thank all three of you so much for coming here and sharing your stories with us and our listeners.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So I have been speaking with Mo Korchinski, Wendy Spruill, and Katrina Cody.